From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Embattled Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick has been charged with perjury and other crimes. Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy made the announcement at a press conference this morning.
Today we have filed a 12-count criminal information that contains charges against Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick and Christine Beattie. In count one, we charge both of them with conspiracy to obstruct justice, a 5-year felony. That count states that they did unlawfully conspire, combine, confederate, and agree together with each other and others to commit the following listed offense, obstruction of justice.
Kilpatrick came under scrutiny in January after the Detroit Free Press published racy text messages he and his aide exchanged. The flirty text messages contradicted testimony Kilpatrick and the aide gave in a lawsuit that produced a multi-million-dollar settlement. The Detroit City Charter says any elected official convicted of a felony has to be removed from office. Joining me now, we've got Jerome Vaughn. He's the program news director at NPR's Detroit affiliate, WDET. Jerome, great to have you on again.
Thanks, Ryan.
So it has been a big day already. And, you know, basically, Kim Worthy, the Wayne County prosecutor, said that Kilpatrick's position shouldn't influence whether he's prosecuted. Let's hear what she had to say.
The blindfold that she wears does not mean that we turn a blind eye or give a wink and a nod, no matter how inconsequential that some may think that may be, to crimes committed by a person who has means, political power, a name, or influence. If that is done, the process is not fair or impartial.
Jerome, two things. One, which do you think is the most significant charge against the mayor? And two, just fill us in very briefly on the whole background of the lawsuit. And, you know, it's a sort of tangled case that involves the scintillation of sex, but that's not really what these charges are about.
No, really, the story goes back a long way. And basically, there was a lawsuit a few years last year about whistleblowers. A few police officers say they were unjustly fired for investigating some allegations of wrongdoing on the part of the mayor's executive protection staff. And as this tale unfolded, it seems to show that the mayor and his administration had some concern about if these officers investigated those allegations about the executive protection staff, they might find out about the mayor's alleged affair. And so that's sort of the soap opera that began this whole thing. The mayor settled the case for, more than $8 million last year. It happened quickly, and people started asking questions at that time. Why did he settle for basically what the officers were asking for? And what no one knew at the time were the lawyer for the officers had these text messages. He brought that attention to the mayor's lawyers, and the mayor's lawyers said, we'll settle it. Over the past few months, the Detroit Free Press published some of these text messages, and we were off to the races from there.
When you think about what's unfolded already, the mayor has said that he's not going to resign. Did that take you personally by surprise? And what do you think, what situation does this put the city of Detroit into to have this be ongoing? Some people have asked, through resolutions or simply, informally that he resign. That's not the case. What turmoil does that throw the city into?
I think that's an excellent point. The mayor has said repeatedly he's not going to resign. The way that he's phrased it to Detroit residents is, I would never quit on you. And so he says that he's on a mission from God to run the city, to make it all that it can be. And many pundits have said if that's something he actually believes, that it would be almost impossible to get him to resign because he feels like his charge to run the city is not just from the citizens of Detroit, but from on high. What it's done is it's really split the metro region, people very staunchly pro-Kilpatrick, others very staunchly anti-Kilpatrick. And the question is, now that he's been charged, how is it going to play out in the business community? He's already lost some business support. Other people are afraid that this means he won't have the same clout in trying to bring development to Detroit and trying to work out political deals. People will wonder if they can trust the mayor.
Well, Jerome, thank you, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon.
My pleasure.
WDET Program News Director Jerome Vaughn joined us from Detroit by phone. Now turning to economics, the housing market is in a shambles. Oil and food prices are skyrocketing. The U.S. dollar is slumping and stocks are on a bumpy ride. Gloomy economic news is most of what we hear these days, but the choices that you make can transform your relationship to money, even through these tough economic times. Here with some big picture advice is author and economist Julianne Malveaux. She is also the president of Bennett College. Great to have you on again.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So before we dig into some practical methods that you can help turn around your economy, let's get a good picture of what's going on. Many experts say that we're already in a recession. Do you agree with that?
The data don't suggest that we are, but for African Americans in particular, you know, when some people have a cold, other people have a fever. We have seen negative growth. We have seen high unemployment rates. We have seen the impact of gas prices over $100 a barrel. And so I think that whether we're in a technical recession or not, people are feeling the pinch of an economy that is not doing well.
So when you think about the fact that people have to live their lives and there's all these other big decisions that are being made on the federal level and in the business community, what should we pay most attention to as we watch the news, listen to the news, read the news? What should we be looking at? Interest rates, at, you know, government policies in terms of getting a sense of what's going on with the big picture?
I think that people should be paying attention to how all of this works for them. Of course, interest rates are important, and the Fed does not have very more arrows in their quiver. When you start cutting interest rates below 3%, I think certainly gas prices, I think the whole issue of the home mortgage market, all these things are important. But in a very short run, Farai, you have to pay attention to how it matters to you. In other words, you've got people who are seeing their food prices rise by 30%. You've got people whose commute is 20% more expensive. And so the macro is very important, but the micro for individuals is even more important.
Let's dig into that. The Washington Post reported that goods and services have gone up about 4% since last year. You mentioned a couple of different items, gas for commuting and food. Why are some of these going up, and how profound is it?
With a gas piece, you've got essentially a Middle Eastern market that's not inclined to produce more. Meanwhile, you have a Chinese market that's inclined to demand more. So you have more people looking for less stuff, and the prices go up. In terms of food, I think you have something quite similar. You have an import-export market, and you have things like eggs. Right. There was a piece in the Post yesterday that talked about eggs and how eggs have gone up by 30%. Well, that's a kind of staple food, bread, milk, other things that have gone up because partially we're exporting, partially the supply and demand thing is unbalanced.
We're feeling the pinch. It doesn't look like prices are going down anytime soon. Experts are always giving tips about how to maximize your 401k, save on travel, pay down credit cards. But what about things that are like eggs, bread, milk? How do you assess the ways that you can cut back on, not cut back on the necessities, but maybe get them at a rate that's a little bit more comfortable for you? What should you start looking at in terms of budget planning?
Those are the two words, budget planning. Look at how you're spending, what you're doing about it, what you can economize on. Look at bulk spending, places, you know, the Walmarts and the Costcos, and not endorsing those at all, but places where you can certainly get bulk spending. Oftentimes that's difficult. Going with a neighbor, going with a friend. Looking at just ways that you can save $50 or $100 a month, because that $100 a month is $1,200 a year. There are lots of other big things, as you say. Everyone's got tips about their 401k and other things, but the bottom line for an individual family or an individual person is, how are you able to take the hit and not end up in the hole? How are you able essentially to juggle what's happening with your necessities to make sure that you don't end up in more debt? And we see about $17 billion worth of new debt in our society. We see credit card debt that's crazy. The other thing I would tell people is, be careful about your credit cards. Don't use them as necessities. Those are some of the kind of things that people can juggle.
Just briefly, you mentioned go in with someone if you're going to a big bulk retailer. Do you mean literally, like, say, okay, here's the enormous, enormous pack of toilet paper, and instead of buying the whole thing, I'm just going to go in and someone else will take half off my hands?
Absolutely. I mean, oftentimes, here's the thing that really kind of baffles me about our country. The people who need the bulk spending most are so far away from it. So you want to get the 24 rolls for some cheaper price, but you've got to spend all this money. Go in with a friend, divide it up. You take half, I take half, and we'll just split the price. So those are, I mean, it's creative. It seems fundamental and rudimentary, but it might make a difference in the long run. And that's what we're really looking at, is that if you think the economy is going to turn down, and we see that it is, how can you protect yourself? We can have a very high-minded conversation about what's going on, and then the micro is, how does it affect you? And then when you figure that out, you go through your budget, you look at what you're spending, and you say, what can I do to make it better for me? And that's one of the things, Farai, that you can do. You can say, let's go in with a friend on this. Let's buy in bulk and split it in half. Those kinds of things.
All right. Well, Dr. Malveaux, we are going to go ahead and take a break, but I know you're able to stay around with us. We're grateful for that. And just ahead, we've got more economics talk with Julianne Malveaux, and our Bloggers Roundtable digs into the indictment of the Detroit mayor, plus the evolution of the conversation about Obama's race speech. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are talking with author and economist Julianne Malveaux about ways to make sure you get the most out of your money in these tough economic times. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So let's put this in the context of what a lot of urban neighborhoods look like, which is that you don't have a lot of grocery stores. You have public transportation, which can be better or worse depending on where you live. You don't have a lot of the larger retailers with the deeper discounts that are clustered in the central cities. And if you live in a rural area, well, you know, you obviously have a long way to travel sometimes to get to some of the bigger stores. So what are ways, if you don't have, for example, your own transportation, that you should think about strategizing about how you buy, what you buy, and where you buy it?
You're carpooling, you're basically being creative with neighbors, you're having conversations about how people can help each other. We're in a situation right now, Farai, where, as I said, the macro looks grim, but the micro looks even grimmer. If you're someone in the situation that you described in an inner city, not near any grocery stores, you've got to figure out how to make it work. The neighborhood mom and pop, they may mean well, but they're charging, you know, maybe 40 or 50% more than you might pay at a grocery store or at a bulk discount store. So people have got to be creative. And that's the thing with this economy, is that you're doing a great service to have this conversation about the creativity that people can bring to the table. We don't have to lay down and take it. In other words, you don't have to pay those extra prices. You can do things to make sure that you essentially fight recession, if that's what it is, back.
Do you think that there's, I mean, a lot of places, for example, like churches and community centers, do try to bring people together and deal with economics as well as whatever else they deal with. But do you think there needs to be more of that? Do you think there needs to be more organization so that people can find ways just to, you know, exist day to day on the bottom line?
You know, for I think that cities can do more to create the kind of spaces that are economically empowering, where you get economies of scale. Why do these great bulk retailers go to suburbs where people don't need those economies, but not to inner cities where people really do? And that, it's a question that I always raise when I look at the ways that we organize commerce. What can we do to make it easier for people who live in inner cities to enjoy scale economies. And so we need activists, legislators, who are prepared to make the case to these retail establishments that there are reasons why they should be in inner cities.
When you think about the big picture, too, of housing, it strikes me that a lot of people right now are seeing their housing costs or their housing values diminish. How is that going to shape their ability to spend on things ranging from college education for their kids to just the necessities? I mean, is this home crunch, even if you're not moving or not trying to move, going to affect overall issues in your family?
It absolutely is. And you hit me where I live when you talk about college pricing. Certainly, what's going to happen is if you see neighborhood property values go down, people are going to have less home equity to use for other things. But additionally, this is a time when activist lawyers need to step in to make sure that no one is being taken advantage of. And we know that there are tens of thousands of people around the country who are being taken advantage of because they got into bad deals. And so these bad deals are going to affect all of their spending decisions into the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And so there certainly is a case to be made for consumer activism around what's happening in terms of property ownership.
Well, Dr. Malveaux, thanks so much.
Thank you, always.
That was author and economist Julianne Malveaux. She's also the president of Bennett College, and she spoke to us from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Cartoons and comics can be simple enough to keep a child happy and rich enough to depict a nation's culture and politics. Sex, race, government, war, all have been addressed directly or indirectly in comics. During the early part of this century, it was hard to find cartoons and comics that didn't broadly stereotype black life. Jackie Orms bucked that trend. Her cartoons were published in the black newspaper, The Pittsburgh Courier, in the 1930s. She was as smart, sexy, and politically conscious as some of the popular characters she drew. Nancy Goldstein authored the biography Jackie Orms, the first African-American woman cartoonist. Nancy, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Farai.
So I'm looking at a comic strip from 1937 where the character Torchy Brown is boarding a train to New York. Why don't we start there? Describe the strip a little bit, like her style and what's going on.
Well, this is titled Torchy Brown in Dixie to Harlem. And this is the story. It goes for 1 year and tells the escapades of this young girl. She grew up on a farm, but she longed to go to Harlem and dance and sing in the Cotton Club. And so this makes for a whole year of really hilarious situations and predicaments that she gets into. But it also, as you said, at another level, tells us a lot about what was going on in real lives at the time. So, okay, here's this September 1937 Torchy strip, and she's running away from home, and she gets to the train station, and she looks on the wall there, and there's an arrow in one direction for colored, and an arrow in the other direction for white. And she says, I'll just pretend I can't read very well. So she's kind of outlining a strategy here as an undercurrent of a very funny little predicament. So she goes to sit in the white section, the more comfortable section, and the conductor finds her, and he gives her a gesture. Oh, no, go to the back. But a man sitting by her says, hey, you've got a newspaper. Have you got the Joe Louis News? And so he brings her up to sit with him, and he speaks in kind of a broken dialect. He's Italian, and as you can tell by his appearance and some of this dialect. And he tells the conductor, oh, this little lady is my very good friend. Run along, Mr. Conductor. I have lots of reading to do.
So it's setting up the whole idea of how a woman has to navigate the worlds of Jim Crow.
Exactly.
At the same time, she's this very sassy character, and you know, so many of the characters here are very you know, just sexy kind of contemporary figures, and
yes. There's
a joie de vivre about this. And even though she touches on a lot of heavy themes, including race and patriotism, there's a certain sass to this. Is that what attracted you to her work?
Well, I was astounded at her work. I was actually looking for something else in her cartoon that is in the late 40s. Most of her cartooning was done in the late 40s and early 50s. This one year of 37 was kind of a little different thing. I was looking for evidence of a doll. I knew that she created a doll, and I thought I could find some evidence of that in her cartoons. And then, yeah, I found the doll, but then I went on to see all of the different topics that she took on, and that got fascinating. But you're right, the visual representations that she makes are stunning. She has beautiful people dressed very fashionably, speaking in this, you know, very outspoken, opinionated way. And I had just never seen this. And when I looked up some of the references about her, I couldn't find much on her. So I made it my job to gather up all I could find and ended up writing a book.
You have a picture in the book of her with Duke Ellington in the mid-50s at a party. That shows, you know, and she's you know, there on his arm. And so she must have had quite a standing in the community.
Well, she did. She was known for putting on fashion shows in Southside Chicago, where she lived. She was very well-dressed. And in fact, later, some of her cartoon comic strips would have paper dolls with high fashion in them. So she was very keyed into the fashion world and to fashionable people. Her husband, Earl, managed upscale hotels in the South Side because at this time, entertainers, travelers, business people of color could not get a room in the Loop. So there were several elegant hotels in the South Side, and Earl managed one of those. They lived in the hotel. And I think from there, as well as from her own stature as a cartoonist whose work was read every week, coast to coast, she did gain a lot of stature and a lot of friends. There's another picture in the book of her with Eartha Kitt. And then going through some of her archives in the DeSable Museum of African American History in Chicago, I found letters from people like Mrs. Louis Armstrong and Marva Lewis, Joe Lewis's wife. So she that was the circle she traveled in. Although she still was very interested in the lower social economic life of Southside Chicago, and she did a lot of philanthropic work at that level too.
Now let's talk about how her work was distributed. She was exclusive for the black paper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and you might think that that would just leave her with a small local audience, but that wasn't the case, was it?
Oh, no, the Pittsburgh Courier was big, and she did have a brief stint cartooning in the Chicago Defender, which a lot of people have heard of. It's very politically very important newspaper, but the Courier was actually bigger even in Chicago. It had a big Chicago edition, had a West Coast edition, East Coast, Texas, National, and 14 different city editions coast to coast. It had a big paid circulation, but more than that, people shared their Pittsburgh couriers. And there are stories of people walking miles to borrow someone's courier. They came out weekly. So a reader really would get their news day to day in the mainstream paper or on the radio. But this aspect of racial pride and presenting stories of achievement and success and issues was so important for readers of the time, because this is the only place you would see lengthy stories of black interest to blacks.
Nancy, we don't have very much time, so very briefly, tell us how she actually was tracked by the government. I mean, comic strips were considered political at this point, and she was investigated by the Justice Department. Just tell us very briefly.
Yes. Well, I knew she must have had some kind of surveillance because her topics were so political. She took on the arms race, the Cold War, freedom of speech. She even named President Truman and talked about the Korean War. So, you know, I made a request at the Justice Department, and I did get her file. But what was interesting is they did not mention her cartoons. They were interested in her friends and associations and investigated her because of those. And she was with intellectuals and artists and others who, yes, I'm sure some were communists, but many were anti-communists, and she certainly was not a communist. But they followed her, and they had informants watching out for her for about 10 years.
Well, Nancy, there's so much more to this story, but we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nancy Goldstein is the author of Jackie Orms, the First African-American Woman Cartoonist. She joins us from WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now a true life tale of intrigue from the first African-American Secret Service agent on the presidential detail. Abraham Bolden was born into a poor family in East St. Louis, Illinois, went to college, and became an Illinois state trooper. After a few years, he joined the U.S. Secret Service. Then in 1961, a chance meeting with President John F. Kennedy changed his life forever. He chronicles his experiences, on-the-job discrimination, and later a conviction on bribery charges in a new memoir, The Echo from Dealey Plaza. Abraham Bolden took me back to the day he was asked to join the White House duty.
I was in Chicago, stationed as a Secret Service agent. The president was on his way to make a visit to Chicago on April 28, 1961. Now, as a new Secret Service agent, I was given a detail in a washroom in the basement of the place where he was speaking, McCormick Place. And at the time that I was given that detail, the agents in the office who were gathered to do the protection for that particular event all snickered and they laughed and says, well, he's got the toilet detail, so to speak. But I went on and without griping or anything, I accepted and I went down to McCormick Place, searched the restroom, made sure that it was secure and everything, and I stood there. Well, as fate would have it, I heard the motorcade as it pulled up. And all of a sudden, I looked at the top of the stairs, and here comes the president. The first thing he wants to do when he arrived at McCormick Place was go to the washroom, and there I stood. And he asked me a question with a slight smile on his face and twinkle in his eye. He said, are you one of Mayor Daley's finest, or are you a Secret Service agent? And I answered, I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President. And he looked at me in the eye. He says, one of the other agents behind him told him my name. Said, that's Mr. Bolden. He's an agent stationed here in Chicago. The president said, Mr. Bolden, he says, has there ever been a Negro on the White House detail protecting and guarding the President of the United States? I said, not to my knowledge, Mr. President. He said, would you like to be the first one? I said, yes, sir, Mr. President. And he said, I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. And that's how I happened to be appointed to the White House detail.
You had that moment, this incredible moment. And then you write very early in the narrative in the book about an agent who was not so friendly. You describe him saying, I'm going to tell you something and I don't want you to ever forget it. You're a nigger. You were born a nigger, and when you die, you'll still be a nigger. So act like one. What did you really face when it came to dealing with your colleagues?
The majority of the Secret Service agents were very acceptable of me coming into the White House detail. There were only a few who were dead set against any integration policies or equal opportunity policies that were being enforced by President Kennedy. Giving equal opportunity to all people regardless of race, religion, color, or ethnic background. And I think that President Kennedy was serious, and he was doing these things not for a political purpose, but because he felt it in his heart that America could be a much better place if we didn't have all of these divisions and restrictions on people of ethnic backgrounds and minorities. So now, I foresaw that the weaknesses in the protection of President Kennedy would allow his assassination if any serious attempt would be made against his life. And I did everything in my power to stem that threat against our young president.
What threats did you hear against the president's life and when?
We had many threats. It was just like a thunderstorm of threats during the early part of 1963 going into November. As a matter of fact, in Miami, Florida, we were told at a record meeting here in Chicago that tape recording had been made of some Cubans who were discussing how they were going to assassinate the president. Now, this tape recording was made just about 3 or 4 weeks before the president was actually assassinated. And they discussed on this tape that the president would be assassinated with a high-powered rifle. The Secret Service was very aware of these threats against the president. Now, once that the president was assassinated, I didn't find any interest in arresting any of these people who were plotting to assassinate the president of the United States, and that disturbed me greatly.
You write in the book, every agent in the Chicago office knew my feelings about the White House detail and that I believed its, and this is in quotes, protection of President Kennedy was a complete sham. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. I heard agents who were on the detail make the statement that they didn't like the president's integration policies. They didn't like his push for equal opportunities for all Americans in the United States. And that if any shots were fired or attempts were made on his life, that they would not do their duties to protect him. And as a result of that, when they failed to perform in Dallas, Texas, and protect our president's life, then that let me know that what they said were, as a matter of fact, true.
You talk about your view that there were at least three groups trying to get at Kennedy, the Cuban emigre population, and I'm quoting you here, who resented him, this is what you say, for his ineffectiveness with Castro, the mafia, and people who were racist or otherwise ideologically opposed to him. Who do you think killed the president?
Well, it's difficult to speculate just who killed the president because, as I said, there were so many conspiracies that were going on prior to November the 22nd. Now, as for my own personal opinion, I believe that there was a conspiracy to assassinate the president. And the Assassination Review Board and also the Congressional Committee who investigated assassinations agreed with me that President Kennedy was probably killed as a result of a conspiracy. Now, they couldn't identify the conspirators because the Secret Service and the FBI had taken means and measures to obfuscate actually the investigations that were going on prior to the assassination of President Kennedy.
At the end of the book, you say that the haunting echo of this experience has been quieted. Do you have a sense of peace now about the path your life has gone?
I have a sense of peace in that I have alerted the American people through the echo from Dealey Plaza of some things that I feel that the American people are entitled to know. And then they can make a fair judgment based upon that book, The Echo from Dealey Plaza. And I hope that they will come down firmly on my side because I tried to be fair in my presentation of both sides of the case.
Mr. Bolden, thank you so much.
Thank you for interviewing me.
Former Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden. His new memoir is called The Echo from Dealey Plaza. But the story doesn't end there. After President John F. Kennedy's assassination, Bolden was arrested on bribery charges, convicted, and spent 6 years in jail. To this day, he maintains his innocence. You can hear him tell us that part of his life story on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. Now, a true life tale of intrigue from the first African-American Secret Service agent on the presidential detail. Abraham Bolden was born into a poor family in East St. Louis, Illinois, got his higher education, and became an Illinois state trooper. After a few years, he joined the U.S. Secret Service. Then in 1961, a chance meeting with President John F. Kennedy changed his life forever. He chronicles his experiences on the job discrimination and later a conviction on bribery charges in a new memoir, The Echo from Dealey Plaza. Abraham Bolden took me back to the day he was asked to join the White House duty.
I was in Chicago stationed as a Secret Service agent. The president was on his way to make a visit to Chicago on April 28, 1961. Now, as a new Secret Service agent, I was given a detail in a washroom in the basement of the place where he was speaking, McCormick Place. And at the time that I was given that detail, the agents in the office who were gathered to do the protection for that particular event all snickered and they laughed and says, well, he's got the toilet detail, so to speak. But I went on and without griping or anything, I accepted and I went down to McCormick Place, searched the restroom, made sure that it was secure and everything, and I stood there. Well, as fate would have it, I heard the motorcade as it pulled up. And all of a sudden, I looked at the top of the stairs, and here comes the president. The first thing he wants to do when he arrived at McCormick Place was go to the washroom, and there I stood. And he asked me a question with a slight smile on his face and twinkle in his eye. He said, are you one of Mayor Daley's finest, or are you a Secret Service agent? And I answered, I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President. And he looked at me in the eye. He says, one of the other agents behind him told him my name. Said, that's Mr. Boland. He's an agent stationed here in Chicago. The president said, Mr. Boland, he says, has there ever been a Negro on the White House detail protecting and guarding the President of the United States? I said, not to my knowledge, Mr. President. He said, would you like to be the first one? I said, yes, sir, Mr. President. And he said, I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. And that's how I happened to be appointed to the White House detail.
You had that moment, this incredible moment, and then you write very early in the narrative in the book about an agent who was not so friendly. You describe him saying, I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want you to ever forget it. You're a nigger. You were born a nigger, and when you die, you'll still be a nigger. So act like one. What did you really face when it came to dealing with your colleagues?
The majority of the Secret Service agents were very acceptable of me coming into the White House detail. There were only a few who were dead set against any immigration policies or equal opportunity policies that were being enforced by President Kennedy, giving equal opportunity to all people regardless of race, religion, color, or ethnic background. And I think that President Kennedy was serious, and he was doing these things not for political purpose, but because he felt it in his heart that America could be a much better place if we didn't have all of these divisions and restrictions on people of ethnic backgrounds and minorities. So now I foresaw that the weaknesses in the protection of President Kennedy would allow his assassination if any serious attempt would be made against his life. And I did everything in my power to stem that threat against our young president.
What threats did you hear against the president's life and when?
We had many threats. It was just like a thunderstorm of threats during the early part of 1963 going into November. As a matter of fact, in Miami, Florida, we were told at a record meeting here in Chicago that tape recording had been made of some Cubans who were discussing how they were going to assassinate the president. Now, this tape recording was made just about 3 or 4 weeks before the president was actually assassinated. And they discussed on this tape that the president would be assassinated with a high-powered rifle. The Secret Service was very aware of these threats against the president. Now, once that the president was assassinated, I didn't find any interest in arresting any of these people who were plotting to assassinate the president of the United States, and that disturbed me greatly.
You write in the book, every agent in the Chicago office knew my feelings about the White House detail and that I believed its, and this is in quotes, protection of President Kennedy was a complete sham. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. I heard agents who were on the detail make the statement that they didn't like the president's immigration policies. They didn't like his push for equal opportunities for all Americans in the United States. and that if any shots were fired or attempts were made on his life, that they would not do their duties to protect him. And as a result of that, when they failed to perform in Dallas, Texas, and protect our president's life, then that let me know that what they said were, as a matter of fact, true.
You talk about your view that there were at least three groups trying to get at Kennedy, the Cuban emigre population, and I'm quoting you here, who resented him, this is what you say, for his ineffectiveness with Castro, the mafia, and people who were racist or otherwise ideologically opposed to him. Who do you think killed the president?
Well, it's difficult to speculate just who killed the president. Because, as I said, there were so many conspiracies that were going on prior to November the 22nd. Now, as for my own personal opinion, I believe that there was a conspiracy to assassinate the president. And the Assassination Review Board and also the Congressional Committee who investigated assassinations agreed with me that President Kennedy was probably killed as a result of a conspiracy. Now, they couldn't identify the conspirators because the Secret Service and the FBI had taken means and measures to obfuscate, actually, the investigations that were going on prior to the assassination of President Kennedy.
At the end of the book, you say that the haunting echo of this experience has been quieted. Do you have a sense of peace now about the path your life has gone?
I have a sense of peace in that I have alerted the American people through the echo from Dealey Plaza of some things that I feel that the American people are entitled to know. And then they can make a fair judgment based upon that book, The Echo from Dealey Plaza. And I hope that they will come down firmly on my side, because I tried to be fair in my presentation of both sides of the case.
Mr. Bolden, thank you so much.
Thank you for interviewing me.
Former Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden. His new memoir is called The Echo from Dealey Plaza. But the story doesn't end there. After President John F. Kennedy's assassination, Bolden was arrested on bribery charges, convicted, and spent 6 years in jail. To this day, he maintains his innocence. You can hear him tell us that part of his life story on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.